Our theme this month is evil, which right off the bat is pretty challenging because not everyone accepts the concept of evil. Next week, with David Smith's help, we'll be looking at what sustains us in the face of evil or devastation, considering and celebrating what can lift us when we need it most. But this week, we are just starting on the topic of evil, and the thing is, we can't all agree on one definition. And I will be offering one later in this sermon, but not yet. I need more time to set it up first. And absolutely, as we sang earlier, we would really like it if nothing evil might ever cross our door. Also, it would be very helpful if it actually was only once that every soul and nation must make an important moral choice. But the truth is, evil can cross any door against all wishes and expectations. And the truth is that living requires both souls and nations again and again to make choices, sometimes truly hard choices, around good or evil. And because the choices can be hard, and because the power of huge corporations and even the corrupting power of power, often souls and nations make the wrong choice, make even the evil choice. As the 19th century English politician and historian John Dalberg Acton famously wrote, power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. In case you were wondering who said that, it was him. Or as the great, contemporary, now living Baptist and United Church of Christ preacher, one of my favorite preachers, the Reverend James Forbes has declared, enough money makes anything legal. I was so shocked when I first heard him say that. He didn't preach it. He said it in a preaching class I was in. And I thought, anything? And the more I've sat with that and the more I've watched, yes, enough money makes anything legal. Legal regardless of moral, which is even arguably worse. Morality is just sidelined altogether. Waste can be dumped anywhere. Corporations are people. Plastic is overwhelming landfills and seas and all the creatures who depend on those environments. And people can be trafficked, and opioids are everywhere. And enough oil will justify any war or environmental devastation. The thing is, that kind of evil, and yes, I am calling all those realities evil, they are obvious. Whether or not we use the same name, whether or not we agree on which of those examples is the very worst, and we may not, it's all pretty obviously venal and cruel and destructive. And nobody is going to fail to notice that level of bad when it's going on. But part of the power of evil is that it doesn't have to be obvious at all to be still insidious and profoundly destructive. This is the point, in two different ways, of the two profoundly different texts that I am referencing this morning. Let's just be honest. Did any of you do the homework that was possible to do for this service, something that doesn't usually happen, and watch again, or for the first time, either or both of Broadcast News and Dr. Horrible's Sing Along with Law? Go ahead and raise your hand if you... Ooh, a number of people did. How cool is that? You are my favorites now. So the first text is a 1987 movie that some of us may remember, Broadcast News. It was written and directed and produced by an award-winning writer, producer, and director, James L. Brooks, a Jewish guy from Jersey who had this extraordinary impact over 50 years. He created the range of shows and movies he did, The Simpsons, Taxi, Mary Tyler Moore, He wrote and produced these things. Terms of Endearment, Jerry Maguire, Big, As Good As It Gets, and of course, Broadcast News. And the thing he says he's proudest of in all the work he did over all those years is what he called the devil speech in Broadcast News. This is a tirade that's delivered by Albert Brooks, who's playing this gifted and extremely unintelligent reporter named Aaron Altman. And he says this to Holly Hunter, the actress, who plays a gifted news presenter, producer, and she is falling for an ambitious and ethically questionable news reporter played by William Hurt. I certainly cannot do Albert Brooks' delivery justice, but this is part of the speech in my nutshell version. I know you care about him. I have never seen you like this about anyone. So please don't take it wrong when I tell you that I believe Tom, while a very nice guy, is the devil. What do you think the devil is going to look like if he's around? Nobody is going to be taken in if he has a long, red, pointy tail. No, I'm semi-serious here. He will look attractive, and he will be nice and helpful, and he will get a job where he influences a great God-fearing nation, and he will never do an evil thing. He will just, bit by bit, lower our standards where they are important. Just coax along, flash over substance. Just a tiny little bit. And he will talk about all of us in the end are really salesmen. And he'll get all the great women. Back then, in 1987, the way things happened seemed far subtler than they do right now. And so the very real danger inherent in the subtle, small, sometimes, erosion of standards and principles and ethics, of our capacity to hold on to what we know is right and good, was a striking insight that always matters. Nowadays, of course, our world is anything but subtle. Frankly, a subtle danger, even a subtle evil, would feel like a refreshing change. But the impact of the lurid rather than the subtle, the lurid erosion of standards, principles, and ethics, the lurid erosion of our capacity to hold on to the good is the exact same danger, just writ large. It's writ so large at times, I was trying to think of a metaphor, and I thought, you know what it feels like? It feels like we're standing, trying to look at the Hollywood sign out in LA, that huge sign on the hill, but we've got our noses like right here. Like, this is me, and this is the Hollywood sign at like maybe the W. And I'm trying to read the whole sign, but it's so enormous that, you know, you just cut your eyes to the right and the left, but there you can't actually even see the whole thing. Because it's right there, and it's so big. Having the scope to take it all in feels overwhelming. So maybe better suited for these lurid times is the second text, which is a more recent source from another prolific movie and TV producer, Joss Whedon, and that's the Dr. Horrible sing-along blog, which is a pet project that Joss Whedon threw together during the writer's strike of 2007-08, which enforced too much time on his hands, and he apparently can't actually sit still. So if you took time to view the blog, you know that it is a brief musical in three acts, that it is clever and silly, farcical and relevant, as all farce is. And it's hard to take the whole thing seriously, I would say, until the end. What happens is Neil Patrick Harris of TV and Broadway fame plays Billy, aka Dr. Horrible, who sees himself as a brilliant villain and wants to get into that nexus of villains, the evil league of evil. But Dr. Horrible doesn't seem horrible at all. He's really sympathetic. He sees how messed up the world is, and he decries what many of us decry, and he has a different solution, which is his own world domination, which we don't really take seriously because he's so sweet. And he's also very inept with Penny, his love interest. And also because, as he himself points out, he has some standards. He doesn't do evil where kids could get hurt. And when the evil League of Evil demands a murder as the price of entry into their company, he doesn't think he can do it until he gets pushed over the edge by the insufferable and egomaniacal superhero Captain Hammer, who is wonderfully played by Nathan Fillion. And it's all a spoof. And we're not really too worried about Hammer, even if he is Dr. Horrible's target, because we've seen how narcissistic and hypocritical Captain Hammer really is. And then it all goes wrong. The freeze ray fails, and the death ray backfires, and Penny is accidentally killed. And Dr. Horrible seems to have everything he was working for. Now he has power and groupies and membership in the League, except that he is shattered and empty. And there it ends. At the end of all the farce, tragedy. And after all, evil, when we had actually stopped expecting it. That's what makes Dr. Horrible relevant, because we often don't expect evil, though we know it's out there. Even nowadays, when the daily news throws us into despair and outrage, we don't expect that gut punch assault of evil in some new or horribly familiar form. And we don't expect it in our own lives, even though we see it. Even though we see it out in the world. In fact, we see it and we become in some way more inured to these developments. And we are shocked when we are assaulted, or someone we know is being abused, or our town is struck by a tornado, or our schools or gatherings or congregations are shot up. But also, we don't really expect it as a faith. In fact, Unitarian Universalists almost never mention evil, per se. In our modern religion, most of us definitely seem not to believe in the devil or hell. I'm sure there are people who do, because in Unitarian Universalism, there's always people who do. But mostly, what I hear and see is people who don't. But to hear us talk, we seem not to even recognize evil. There is very little that has been written on it in the last 60-plus years. And after a lengthy search, I found out that there are only 3 or 4 hymns in our great hymnal that even mention evil. And there are none in the newer Teal hymnal. That's really interesting. We focus on faith, on justice, our inherent worth and dignity, and do not get me wrong, I think we are right to focus on all those things. But we really also don't address evil almost at all. And the potential problem with this is that if we ignore it or deny it or overlook it or reject it or whatever it is that we are doing, when we don't talk about it or write about it or think about it or pray about it or sing about it or name it or evaluate it, then if evil exists and we don't address it, then we can't address it. Which is another way to say we can't really deal with it. M. Scott Peck is a best-selling American philosopher and psychiatrist, and he wrote a book on evil once called People of the Lie. And he said, we cannot begin to help to heal human evil until we are able to look at it directly. It is not a pleasant sight, but judgment needs to be made. He thinks what he calls a psychology of evil can be a healing psychology, and that it must be brimful of love. I hope a theology of evil can be a healing theology, and that there is a place for love even in considering evil. Earlier this morning, you heard an excerpt about Unitarian Universalist theology and evil from the work of a Unitarian Universalist colleague I greatly admire and like, the Reverend Dr. Mark Morrison Reed. And certainly, Mark is absolutely right. There is neo-tribalism and axes of evil rhetoric, but they are spoken of much more in our nation than in our faith. Because our faith, as I've already said, is almost silent and maybe stymied about how to deal with evil. Not Mark Morrison Reed. He told us what he believes, that there is only us and we are all beloved by a God who does not offer us free will and who loves us all. God is love for everyone, period. Mark is African American. He has worked his entire life in Unitarian Universalist ministry. He has studied and written extensively about race in our movement and beyond, so he is pretty familiar with some brutal realities. But what does it mean to say that God is love and that all participate in it, such that bin Laden or Idi Amin or Fred Phelps will be dragged kicking and screaming into heaven? What does that mean? That heaven is where they become magically delicious? Beautiful? Wonderful? Are they changed in heaven? Is heaven where they make amends? Because otherwise, if that's not the case, then heaven is looking a lot like, well, here. And here is definitely not heaven, even on a really good day. So, I'm beginning to go off on a tangent, you may have noticed. But goodness, evil, inherent worth and dignity, free will and agency, these are all inextricably tied together, and it's really hard to look at only one piece without mentioning anything else. Universalism first came into being because people could not believe in, literally could not believe in, let alone worship, a God who would condemn perfectly innocent infants to burn forever in hell, which is what Protestant Calvinism was proclaiming at the time. Most were damned from even before birth, and very, very few would get into heaven. Universalists found another theology they could believe and be part of, universalism, that everyone is born stainless and saved. Maybe we could condemn ourselves by our own actions, but we are not fated inextricably for evil and hell. We were free to choose or not by how we live. And I've mentioned to you before about James Luther Adams. Fast forward a few hundred years, he's a renowned 20th century liberal theologian and a Unitarian. Dr. Adams believed that unexamined faith is not worth having, for it can only be true by accident. Unexamined faith is not worth having, for it can only be true by accident. Authentic faith is an examined, self-critical faith. National culture, for example, he said, the soil of a people, language, poetry, music, common heritage is also the ground for nationalism, one of the most destructive forces in human history. And he was in Germany in the 1930s, and he saw what he was talking about. And this is closely related to what Adams believed about evil. He said, evil is not something foreign to human creativity. It is a perversion of its greatest accomplishments. No human good, no principle, goal, or institution is innately virtuous and free entirely from evil. It is impossible to live with pure motives and perfect vision. Therefore, the need for ongoing self-criticism. You with me? Okay. Theology is always changing. Always. And Mark Morrison Reed nudges it one way. We have no choice and we all go to heaven regardless of, well, regardless. My experiences nudge me another. not that I wish to deny his belief. He has as much reason and justification for what he believes as I do for what I believe. But my experience nudges me another. My life experience includes what I feel are experiences of agency, which suggest to me that sometimes I have had choices and made them. My sense of inherent worth and dignity comes from my belief that we each have something sacred in us that we need to live up to and allow others to live into. Something that every human being has the right to honor and nurture, but that it's not inviolate. We may nourish that spark and make it strong and life-giving, or we may allow it to be quenched by our own or others' actions. And sometimes we are born into circumstances that will quench most divine sparks. And it's up to all of us to work so that that doesn't happen, so that people may be safe and whole, with opportunity and dignity. But our inherent worth and dignity, this is my theology now. I'm not saying this is true. I'm saying this is what I believe. Our inherent worth and dignity are inherent only in that we all possess it, not that nothing we can do would ever end it. I am responsible. We are all responsible. Evil is what challenges that spark or quenches it. And I don't just mean big natural catastrophe stuff like a tidal wave or earthquake. In fact, mostly I'm talking about not the evil of natural disasters, which are often no one's fault, but evil we wrestle with, human-generated evil, known choices that are deliberate, something that's either known or intended to hurt and destroy. It may not be intended to, it may just be a side thing that we know it does do that, we're doing it for some other reason, but we know it'll also hurt or destroy. Or that's actually the whole point, is that it will hurt and destroy. That kind of choice is fast friends with selfishness and the absence of compassion and usually violence. Or, to use M. Scott Peck's words, evil is that which opposes the life force, which kills the spirit, the force residing either inside or outside of human beings that seeks to kill life and liveliness. It is challenging to look at what tips us over into evil as opposed to just troubled or misled or embracing different values. The examples Dr. Peck gives are people who are cold and destructive to their family members who depend on them. He's talking in psychological terms, so it kind of makes sense. These are not people who are struggling with something. These are people who maintain a facade of being good, even to themselves, which is why he calls them people of the lie. They don't wish to be good. I want to be clear about this. These are not people who wish to be good and struggle. These are people who wish to appear good, even though at heart they do not wish to be. Despite their church going, despite their jobs, homes, duties, they are destructive, and he goes so far as to say evil. But it's also important because we can get stuck on the excuses and reasons and justifications for evil behavior and choices. Maybe we're afraid of perceiving evil. Maybe we're afraid of misjudging something or someone, which is a legitimate fear. We've all done it. Maybe we don't want to judge lest we be judged. But none of that actually does save us from being judged in this real and really flawed world in which we live. It doesn't absolve us of the ability or the responsibility to consider evil. We have to be real about our world. So speak no evil, see no evil, hear no evil is not a responsible option. I remember my shock at Unitarian Universalist colleagues who, on the first day after 9/11, bear in mind I was in DC at the time, on the first day after 9/11, went to great lengths to affirm the inherent worth and dignity of all the plane's hijackers. And it seemed to me then, and it still seems to me now, that the hijackers' inherent worth and dignity were at least questionable. And any discussion of it, of them, would require time and evaluation. And not this knee-jerk affirmation which flooded social media and email threads. At what point do we draw the line and say, we are not going to focus on cultural differences and the impact of poverty or disenfranchisement or ignorance. We're going to go ahead and say we, or in this case I, consider that the Taliban was evil, that Osama bin Laden and what he led was evil, not only because of what they did on 9/11, but also because of their cruel and violent ways towards all dissenters, especially towards women, towards also the brilliant young Pakistani leader Malala Yousafzai, because she advocates education for girls, for her anti-Taliban and secular thoughts, which they consider to be capital crimes, for their promise that they will try again to kill her if they can. In this complex world, with all its different understandings that are real about morality and human rights, we can say, yes, differences exist, and some are cultural or social or human constructs. Evil itself is always a human construct. But all society is a human construct, and societies are real in that they have very real consequences for all the people they impact. And we can also still say we believe this construct that the Taliban operates by is evil. And evil we knowingly commit to becomes evil that defines us. And I know not all Unitarian Universalists, including some of you here, may agree with me, but the conversation has to happen. And at this point, it's important for me to say that Regarding Evil, which is the kind of blah sermon title I have for us today, is not a great name for this sermon, not only because it's boring, which it is. That's not a gift. Sexy sermon titles is a growing edge for me, and I think we can all agree. But when we regard anything, we regard it from a distance, don't we? And this takes me back to that Hollywood sign, and it's easy for me to point to the Taliban or blood diamond traffickers or human traffickers and call them evil without acknowledging that there might be anything wrong with me, in me, that is evil. But I can be cruel. I have been cruel. And I have prejudices and ignorance in me. And I can be violent, and I can be mean, and I can be selfish. I have been all those things. And I likely will be again, to my sorrow. And it is not noble or enough to stand up here and say so. It is only worthwhile to acknowledge all that if I also commit to be better and to wrestle with my own evils. It is not just, it's not even possible without hypocrisy to spy out evil only in others and not in oneself. Part of building a better world depends on identifying evils that are part of the construction around us and in us, as well as in each other, if they are to be dismantled. And we may be comforted by Dr. Peck's point that evil deeds do not necessarily an evil person make. Otherwise, we would all be simply evil. But listen to that. No one is free of evil deeds. Does that sound strange? Because that's not the way we talk. We've all done bad things, sure. We have all done evil things? Really? Yikes! Small lies and betrayals are not the same as large lies and betrayals. But they are also not nothing. And we do ourselves and those with whom we are in relationship no favors when we let ourselves off the hook for small lies and betrayals, the little evils that could comprise every day and diminish our standards if we let them. It brings us back both to broadcast news and James Luther Adams and that need for an examined life and an examined faith, re-examined pretty regularly. And also what Dr. Peck calls the blessing of guilt. The blessing of guilt, which turns us away from an evil impulse or act back to the good. He says evil originates not in the absence of guilt, but in the desire to escape it. In other words, it's not our unwillingness to consider anything or anyone evil. It's not our unwillingness to consider anyone or anything actually evil that will save us. He thinks it's only acknowledging evil, including feeling guilt for our own burdens of evil. One last thing about evil. It seems to me that it requires isolation. It seems to me that it requires the belief or the experience that we are not connected in mystery and miracle to each other, not connected in an interdependent web of all things to each other and to the great all. Only then, in singularity, do we feel the distance, the distrust, the separatism, the elitism, the resentment, the defensiveness, the anger, the insecurity that is so perceptibly at the foundation of all evil choices people make at the expense of others. And this suggests to me that the solution, or part of the solution, to evil is community. By which I mean not the community of like-minded, aggrieved, and isolated people, but the community of different people coming together in commitment to the rights and beauty of each other and others beyond their circle. In which case, such communities are not only sources of strength or solace, celebration or wisdom, but also in real ways, sources of goodness that support and refine us in the face of large or small diminishments and erosions that are often all around us for the taking, or even just the allowing. Wow! Evil, guilt. Maybe I'm not addressing sin only because I'm out of time this week. Is this Unitarian Universalism? Can we hear the word evil and take it seriously? Or is evil too big or bad for us to bear? Can we hear it about others? Can we hear it about ourselves? While it is essential in Unitarian Universalism that we affirm the inherent worth and dignity of all human beings and the goodness and welcome we therefore extend to each other in our congregations, I think also that we must keep evil in our theological vocabulary and our awareness. That sing-along blog is a cautionary tale. We can't flirt with evil and emerge unscathed. And broadcast news warns us we cannot diminish evil or explain it away if we are to truly help build the world we dream about. So we may have left a lot of old-time religion behind in Unitarian Universalism, but reality these days is not for the faint-hearted, and it is not for rose-tinted theology. We may not always love these days we have been given, but the seeds of better understanding and real goodness are still in them, if we have the strength and the clarity for them. So let's make sure we are together, and let's make sure we are real. Amen.